morning. We're delighted to welcome students from the School District of Loyal. Was it Loyal? Second one.
Loyal.
Loyal. All right. Loyal sounds quite nice, though. But this is not the time to change the name. So, if the students from the school district would stand, please, so we can greet them.
Large group.
Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to come to the court and join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case we're about to hear. They come, and then at noon, after the second case, all the students are here for the day and will be joined by a justice. Today it'll be Justice Bradley. And they will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the court case that we're about to hear. Everyone's invited to join the students at the discussion. It's not limited to the students. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice of the court. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, with whom you'll meet after this case is concluded. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our next case, 08AP1494. Earl Miller versus the Hanover Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Zurich American Insurance Company is Lester Pines. And Mr. Pines, you will then have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And then we'll conclude by a surrebuttal by Attorney Urban. Is that the agreement?
That's my understanding.
That's what my paper says. Go ahead. Mr. Pines.
May it please the court, I'm Lester Pines. I represent the Zurich American Insurance Company. With me at council table is my colleague, Attorney Kira Lair. This case is about the requirements for a plaintiff to gain a default judgment. The basic law in the state of Wisconsin is this. Default judgment is an extraordinary remedy. And it is particularly disfavored. The law prefers, whenever reasonably possible, to afford litigants a day in court and a trial on the issues, and as a corollary to this preference, default judgments are regarded with particular disfavor. Now, because of that, there are steps which a plaintiff, and in this case, the plaintiff moved for default judgment, there are steps which a plaintiff must follow before a default judgment can be entered in the plaintiff's favor. The first step is that the complaint be served and filed in the manner and within the time prescribed by the statute. The second step is to show that it has pled a sufficient cause of action. Only if the plaintiff meets those steps can a court consider granting a default judgment. As to the default judgment that Zurich has appealed here, the issue is about the first step. Did the plaintiffs serve their amended complaint in the manner prescribed by law? That is the issue here. Zurich asserts that the record is crystal clear that the plaintiffs did not serve their complaint in the manner prescribed by the statute. The statute we're talking about is Section 801.14 sub 2, which states, whenever under these statutes service of pleadings or other papers is required or permitted to be made upon a party represented by an attorney, the service shall be made upon the attorney. That is a mandatory requirement. Shall be made upon the attorney. The only exception is unless service upon the party in person is ordered by the court.
Here's my problem. We have an amended summons and complaint.
Yes.
And the amended summons and complaint in this case, as I understand it, does not refer to the original or incorporate the original summons and complaint. Is that right? And I'll tell you, I sort of looked at it
quickly. It makes a new allegation against Zurich.
Yeah. New allegations doesn't refer back.
That's right.
And as I read the Holman case that's cited by everybody in their briefs, the amended complaint supersedes or supplants the prior complaint. And I didn't go back and reread all the cases that are cited in footnote 5 of that. When an amended complaint supersedes a prior complaint, the amended complaint becomes the only live operative complaint in the case on which default judgment can be entered.
That's correct.
Okay. So we got a new complaint. We've got a new summons.
If I can interrupt, Your Honor.
Well, you see where I'm going.
There is a new summons, not as to Zurich. There's a new summons because a new party was brought into the case.
Well, wasn't Zurich served with the new summons?
Zurich was served with the new summons, but the new summons was a nullity as to Zurich because an amended complaint is not served with a summons. An amended complaint stands on its own. The summons that previously brought Zurich into the case got the court personal jurisdiction over Zurich.
Okay. Was Zurich served with the summons and amended complaint?
Not in accordance with the statute, but its but registered agent was served.
Okay. So, if it's true, then, as paragraph says in Holman, if it's true that this is the operative, the amended complaint is the operative document, and your client, sounds to me that Holman is saying, it's a brand new suit. So if it was a brand new suit, there is no prior lawyer in the case that should be served.
But that's not what Holman says,
okay.
And it's not a brand new suit.
That's my problem.
It can't be a brand new suit.
Okay.
Because it's an amended complaint, mm-hmm. And the amendment of the complaint is making allegations against the party that was already in the case. And this is quite important. The undisputed facts are that Zurich American Insurance Company was always a party to the case. James Ratzel was always Zurich's attorney of record. At the time the amended complaint was filed, Ratzel was the attorney of record. The Millers never served Ratzel. So when what the statutes require, and there's no exception for an amended complaint, what the statutes require and what 801.14 sub 2 requires is that service be made on a party who is represented by counsel. The plaintiffs in this case specifically requested that Zurich remain in the case. They made that request. The court never dismissed Zurich out of the case. Zurich was always in. Ratzel was always its attorney of record. Consequently, an amended complaint makes new allegations against Zurich, but that's all. It doesn't start the case over. Because there has been a continuum where Zurich has always been present in the case. And that's the fundamental issue here. There is nothing in the statutes that would allow for personal service on a party who is represented by counsel once that attorney has appeared. And there's no basis for making an exception to that, because if the court makes an exception to that, it will create chaos. The statutes are written so that a party can rely on the fact that it has an attorney. And then the statutes say, once a party has appeared by counsel, the service shall be made. And Bell versus Employers Mutual Casualty said, once the action was commenced, an attorney appeared on behalf of the defendant. 801.14 directed that service of the pleadings and other papers would be on the defendant's attorney unless otherwise ordered by the court. So there's really no wiggle room here at all.
Well, it seems to me there's wiggle room if you ask, represented by an attorney for what?
Well,
I mean, the assertion is that the representation here was for the 102.29 claim, the subrogated claim. And
well, Your Honor,
why isn't that a valid assertion?
There is another bright line rule in this case. Mm-hmm. When an attorney makes an appearance in a case, there are only two ways an attorney can no longer be the attorney of record. And both of them require a court order. Either there's a stipulation for substitution of counsel, which is followed by an order substituting in the new attorney, or there's a motion to withdraw as counsel, followed by an order granting that, or an order denying. Absent a court order, an attorney who has appeared is in that case until the court says that attorney is out.
What about, put it in the family law context, and Your Honor, I'm representing Bill Jones today, and I'm representing him only with regard to the property division issues. I am not representing him with regard to child custody issues or any kind of maintenance, only with regard to property division. How does that play out with your argument here?
Well, first of all, attorneys don't represent parties and claims. They represent parties. They represent parties. They don't represent parties on claim. But let's say an attorney did that on the record. All right. At that point, the judge would probably say to the party, "Do you understand that you have a lawyer here who's only representing you with regard to property division?" And there would be something on the record. And I suppose a circuit court judge could do that, and sometimes perhaps in family law, maybe it's a little more flexible.
Well, I would imagine that the statutes that you're referring to are the statutes are the statutes.
That's right. The statutes are the statutes.
But this is unbundled legal services, which is permitted under the code. Can represent a party for a limited circumstance.
It's possible, I suppose, but that is not what the circumstance was here.
Well, what about the representation of counsel that he didn't represent them for the underinsured motorist claim?
You know, that representation has been blown fantastically out of proportion. Attorney Ratzel was asked about UIM coverage. He was asked about UIM coverage so the plaintiff's new lawyer, Mr. Urban, could tender to the UIM insurer the settlement that was coming from Acuity of its policy limits, because he has to tender it under void before he can take the money, because the underinsured motorist carrier could agree to take that money and then pay the claim. So he had to have somebody to submit this to, and what Ratzel was saying is, I don't know anything about the UIM claim. I'm here on the workers' comp claim. That is not a statement. I'm only representing them in the future on the workers' compensation claim. What Ratzel was saying is, you're going to have to find somebody who knows about the UIM claim, because I don't. And it turns out, of course, when Urban contacts the employer the next day, the employer says there is no uninsured motorist coverage. And when he contacts GAB Robbins, they say there is no uninsured motorist coverage. Ratzel is still in the case after that. For a number of months, Ratzel participates in this whole process, and then at the settlement of the 102.29 claim, the plaintiffs say, we want Zurich in for other claims, UIM claims, negligence of insurance agent claims, and so on. At that point, Ratzel made no statement to the court, I am no longer attorney of record here, I will no longer be involved in this. So what the plaintiff is asking, asked the circuit court and asked the appeals court, is to say, well, because this lawyer made a statement in this letter to me when I asked him about UIM coverage, that I'm only dealing with the workers' comp coverage, that therefore he has limited his representation and is no longer attorney of record for all purposes. What if Ratzel had said to Attorney Urban, you know, I am sick of this case. I am sick of Zurich. I can't stand this client. You know, once I'm done with this worker stuff, compensation stuff, I don't want anything to do with this anymore. Oh, well, then we'd be here. And the plaintiff could then say, well, he was only he has limited his representation. That would be absurd. And if you deviate from the notion that an attorney of record is an attorney for all purposes until that attorney is allowed to withdraw by court order, you will get into a circumstance which will create chaos in the administration of cases. And I want to come back to what I started out with. The law in our state is that default judgments are disfavored. Default judgments are regarded with particular disfavor. And so even in our discussion this morning, we seem to be talking about a way to salvage a default judgment. Let's find what we can do to keep this default judgment. And it seems like that turns the law in this state on its head.
Counsel, the issue probably is correctly stated as whether or not the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion in granting the default judgment. And when I look at default judgments, they're disfavored in the law and they're disfavored personally. But whether or not they're disfavored personally has nothing to do with my analysis, because I have to first go through the standard of review. So tell me why the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion when it went one way rather than the other.
The circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion because the circuit court misinterpreted Section 802.14 sub 2. The circuit court said 801.14 sub 2 applies in this case, and then went on to say that the first sentence of 801.14 sub 2 meant that Zurich didn't have to be served by through its counsel. What the circuit court said was, well, this part of 801.14 sub 2 is what applies. The last sentence says, the first sentence of this subsection shall not apply to service of a summons or of any process of court or of any paper to bring a party into contempt of court. And as Justice Rogensack, who I know practiced family law for a long time, knows, and all of us know, if you're going to have somebody held in contempt, you can't serve the papers on their lawyer. That's what that line in 804.14 sub 2 says. If you're going to bring somebody in contempt, they have to be personally served. That's the only exception. And the circuit court erroneously interpreted the law and said this section relieves the plaintiffs of their very clear obligation to serve the counsel of record. That's why the circuit court was wrong. The Court of Appeals didn't accept the circuit court's analysis. The Court of Appeals came up with a new exception. And that exception is not found in the statutes anywhere. The statute has one or two ways to serve an amended complaint, on the counsel of record or on the party personally if ordered by the court. That is it. The Court of Appeals says, well, if we have a circumstance where an attorney clearly expresses that his or her representation is limited to a resolved claim under the original complaint. That's what the Court of Appeals said. Where the Court of Appeals came up with that, we don't know, because the Court of Appeals cited no law to support that statement. And the policy problem with this is, as I pointed out, if a party cannot rely on the fact that it is represented by counsel, when a party has an attorney who's appeared, the party is relying on that counsel. The statutes are constructed around that. Only a court may allow an attorney to withdraw. But the Court of Appeals decision has said we can go outside of that construct, and even though a court hasn't allowed an attorney to withdraw, and even though the court knows nothing about any representation that the attorney may have made, knows zero about it, and even though there's no evidence that the party has ever heard about this supposed limitation of representation, and even though there's no record of it anywhere before the court, you don't have to serve the party through their attorney.
Counsel, I'd like both sides, actually, to respond to this, because when I went through the record, well, I first read the briefs, then I was thinking, oh, well, it seems this way. Well, maybe it's this way. And then I thought, well, I need to take a close look at all the filings and what was happening and how this kind of went through. And really, I can see why both lawyers thought what they were thinking at the time. Back in November, there's the letter saying, you know, do you represent on the UIM claim? I can see how counsel can interpret that as, no, I'm only representing on the workers' comp. However, I can see why Attorney Ratzel thinks he's responding, saying, look, what we've got pending right now is a workers' comp. But in any event, shortly after that, we have Miller's counsel sending a letter getting the policies for the UIM claims, and those aren't sought through Mr. Ratzel, or he's not copied on that, I don't think. And then you have the response in January. Then you have that settlement, which specifically keeps Zurich in the case for not just UIM matters, but I think it says potentially other claims involving these defendants. And at the time, you only have Hanover and Zurich in the case, I think.
That's right.
And it says involving these defendants and other issues of UIM. So that's a little broader than just, gee, we might have a UIM claim
right.
coming down the road that could involve Zurich or not. And then you have a stip and order that specifically only dismisses Smith and Acuity, right? So Zurich's still in the loop. Ratzel's still in the loop, I think, because he's still listed as attorney of record. His affidavit says he represents Zurich, at least in the settlement documents. It's not Zurich as to only these claims that I'm out.
That's right.
So I'm piecing through this, and I see in November the court sends out a scheduling conference notice, and you know, I'm trying to think back on how we did that, and I think we tried to copy everybody. You oftentimes copy too many people, but everybody who's in the file, you give them a copy of this, whether they want to show up or not, and especially subrogated parties often are just, you know, they don't come to scheduling conferences. They see their interest and work it out with counsel, whatever. So in November, you have the court sending that notice out, but it's not sent. It's sent to Hanover's counsel, Miller's counsel, and then Zurich American Insurance Company. Then in January, you have counsel sending a letter to the court asking that the case be kept open. It seems like that's only copied to Miller's counsel, Hanover's counsel, the court initials that. Where's Ratzel in that, I'm wondering? And then you have June the letter to the court regarding the amended summons and complaint. And that seems like that was copied to Hanover's counsel, Lyons, but I'm wondering where's Ratzel in that. And then you have the notice of scheduling conference, another one from June of 06, distribution list, Miller's counsel, Hanover's counsel, Zurich American Insurance Company, not Ratzel again, and then you have Massachusetts Bay Insurance Company.
Right.
Then you have the service, and then you have the Lyons letter, then you have another scheduling conference, et cetera. But it's, when I look back on this, I'm thinking, okay, you have a lawyer. I haven't signed anything substituting counsel. I haven't signed anything allowing counsel to withdraw. Why isn't this lawyer being copied by the court? That's one question I have. You know, the court plays a role in this, too.
Yeah.
What's the answer?
For whatever reason, when Ratzel answered the complaint, the original complaint, when Ratzel was in the case, Ratzel was not put on CCAP. That was a mistake by the circuit court. A year and a half after the settlement with Acuity and Smith is when the plaintiff started up with this amended complaint. The court did not have Ratzel on CCAP. This is the only explanation for why they weren't informing Ratzel. So all of this is going on, and Ratzel doesn't know about it because the court has made an error.
How, if at all, does that factor into the excusable neglect equation?
Okay. Well, excusable neglect comes after the plaintiff has shown that it properly served, all right? And we don't even get to excusable neglect if the court accepts my argument.
But what if you do?
But if you get to, if you get to excusable neglect, the circuit court was a player in the mistakes that led to Zurich not being informed. The circuit court's own mistake by not sending all of these notices to Ratzel really contributed to this problem. And I want to say, as well, if you get to the interest of justice analysis, to say, even if you say it wasn't excusable neglect, and even if there's this judgment, what are we looking at here? We're looking at a $2 million judgment against an insurance company that never issued the insurance that the plaintiffs knew before they even filed the complaint there wasn't any underinsured motorist coverage, and their counsel is left in the dark about everything that's going on in the court because the court didn't put him on CCAP. And then it's equitable to enter this judgment? I mean, nothing could be more inequitable. There was a series of mistakes here which led to an unfortunate result. But it was not Zurich's mistakes.
How come the lawyer didn't say, hey, I haven't heard anything from anybody for a decade now. What's happening?
I actually thought you were going to ask me that question. And I'll tell you why. You're a defendant in a lawsuit. And you're a lawyer. You have a lot of clients. There's a lawsuit pending. The plaintiff said, well, you know, one of these days I might get around to file an amended complaint. You have plenty of other work to do. And there's no reason to look to see what's going on.
No. But before the amended complaint was filed, he didn't get notices.
Right. So he...
That's it. He didn't open up his computer to see if there was anything in the court record that he should know about. He could look at CCAP.
Right, he could.
He didn't.
We don't know. We have to assume he didn't because he was a responsible lawyer. He would have done something if he had. But he certainly wasn't under any obligation to tag after this case to see if something's going on after the plaintiff got $102,000, has a UIM claim against a non-existent insurance policy, and they said, well, someday we might be filing something. Why is he responsible to then trail along to find out what's going on in the case? The defendant is waiting for the plaintiff to do whatever the plaintiff is going to do.
Let me ask one more question. When you file an amend after the 6 month as of right time period to file an amended pleading, do the other parties have the opportunity to object to that filing, or is that just
a
communication with one party in the court and the court decides and that party proceeds on?
When a motion is made for leave to file, the parties to the case have an absolute right to appear and to object to the court allowing the amendment.
Did you make that argument, or was it made on behalf of your client in circuit court? Because it's a footnote.
Yes, and
in
it was made in the, it was made extensively in the Court of Appeals.
But I asked about the circuit
court. It was made in the circuit court, yes.
So if that's the argument, then the whole amended complaint is void.
The whole amended complaint is void.
Where do you say that in your briefs?
We didn't brief that in this court because we petitioned for review on the issue primarily on the issue of service. We did not brief that issue. We briefed it extensively in the Court of Appeals, and we do believe that the granting of the leave to amend was void, and the complaint is void. That's just not something that we concentrated on because we believe that the crucial issue here, although if the court wants to look at the issue of whether or not the amended complaint is void, I encourage you to do so because it is void. But the issue of service of process, from Zurich's point of view, is unassailable.
It seems to me a little odd that the client complains that it got notice and its lawyer didn't. I mean, there's no doubt Zurich's appropriate agent was served here, right?
That's true.
And the reason that there was a default was that there was just error
That's
in the
true.
Corporation.
That's
right?
true. But the service had no legal effect because the wrong person was served. Ratzel is the only person because the statute says he shall be served. They could have taken out a billboard in Schaumburg, Illinois to give actual notice to Zurich too. But the point is Zurich, whether they were served, whether their registered agent was served or not, that's icing on the cake. The point is the statute says their lawyer was supposed to be served. And it's not that Zurich is saying, well, you know, this is just a technicality. When the plaintiff is seeking a $2 million default judgment on a policy that doesn't exist, they should be held to the strict standards.
Mr. Pines, if it was $2,000, it's either valid or invalid. It doesn't matter whether it's $2 million.
And we contend that if a party seeking a default judgment does not follow what the statutes say, they can't get a default judgment.
And they can't get a default judgment here on the first complaint that was validly served, which Holman says there in Family Service they could,
right,
because that first complaint doesn't make a UIM.
That's right.
Okay. Got it.
Thank you.
We have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Mr. Urban, representing the Millers.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Jay Urban, and I represent the Miller family. With me at counsel table is attorney Jennifer Wilson of my office and my co-counsel, Robert Mubarak. In this case is really...
How do I raise this? Does this mean...
Yes, it does. You want to...
Thank you.
Bye.
I can't see that far. Does that mean that you can't trust a registered agent? The legislature has made a determination and set forth in 601.715 another mandatory statute. 801.14 is a Supreme Court rule made statute. 601.715 says you shall serve an insurance company. I was there. Mr. Pines wasn't there. I was not playing a game of gotcha. I was playing a claim. This is a serious case. These losses are catastrophic, and I'm sorry about that. We're not here for sympathy. But this is a serious case, and the only thing on my mind was how do I get jurisdiction over this insurance company? And I tried to do it as nicely as I possibly could, and it's being completely misconstrued through the appellate courts. The trial court saw through it, the Court of Appeals saw through it, and we hope you see through it too. We served the registered agent under 601.75.
Counselor, you may be trying to be nice, but I think the argument is, was something else required of you? So I don't think the argument here is that somehow you were being devious, or at least I didn't understand that to be the argument. I think the argument really is, did you have an obligation under the statute that you didn't fulfill? So that's what's bothering me, frankly.
Okay. We fulfilled it. 601.715 is a mandatory statute made by the legislature. It can't be changed by a procedural rule. It's a jurisdictional statute. So when 601.715 is in play and it says shall, the Bell case stands for the proposition that you may also serve an attorney. An attorney can refuse service. If Mr. Ratzel was refusing to accept a vote letter, which is not just some letter, it's mandatory. If that vote letter wasn't achieved and Zurich took almost two-thirds of the amount of the $102,000 salvaged from the tortfeasor, Zurich took $62,000 of it. So Zurich had a claim as a plaintiff. It might have been named as an involuntary defendant, but under 803.03, it should have been named as an involuntary plaintiff. So they have a subrogation interest. Mr. Ratzel, this is record page 1, appendix page 1, specifically enters an answer where he says, we specifically assert an interest in this action pursuant to 102.29. Zurich affirmatively claims an interest to the full extent of any workers' compensation benefits that have been paid or will be paid on behalf of the plaintiff, Verl Miller. And then in the wherefore clause, it just says it demands judgment to the full extent of its interest set forth in accordance with 102.29 statutes. Once Zurich got paid and Mr. Ratzel took a part of the plaintiff's fee, by the way, $2,500, and made a motion to the court. He made a motion to the court saying his interest was over with. This isn't one factor that Mr. Ratzel was saying he wasn't attorney. He was telling everybody he wasn't attorney. And Zurich, through G.A.B. Robbins, was telling us that Attorney Lyons was the attorney because Attorney Lyons did the vote letter. Vote versus Schrader is a Supreme Court case, 1986. You cannot make a UIM claim unless you first get approval to accept that settlement. To take the logic of the defendants, Zurich owes Acuity $62,000 back because then it's an illegal vote letter. The vote letter is an official act, an official pre-suit act to identify who is counsel for the UIM carrier. And in this case, the way insurance works, sometimes it's a TPA, a third-party administrator. I don't make those choices. Zurich made those choices. Zurich made those choices. General Parts made those choices that it will be GAB. And that's all Attorney Lyons. And so he's signaling to me that he's going to be the attorney. That's why, Justice Ziegler, when you asked your question, this is appendix page 168. That's why, to the court, I started copying in Attorney Lyons. He didn't represent Hanover. I know it's confusing because there's a bunch of, there's a Hanover and Mass Bay are sister companies. But Mr. Lyons, then, I'm starting to give him notice on behalf of Zurich. It wasn't until I tried to serve him with the complaint that he said, well, maybe I can't accept service. And that's common practice. The chaos that will be created that Mr. Pines and Zurich alleges, the chaos will be created if you change the service rules. And I know many of you have been trial court judges. Subrogated parties often are named. A perfect example, I can't think of a UIM claim that I've made in the last 10 years where the subrogated party hasn't also been the same as the UIM. And if you start serving the subrogated party and say that you've got jurisdiction, you're ignoring the legislature, which is 601.715. If Zurich wants to change that rule, I'm fine with that. But they have to go through the legislative process to do it. We have jurisdiction in this complaint. They waited 91 days. They were served with notice of default, and they waited an additional 3 weeks to the 91st day before they actually filed their answer.
Counsel, somewhere in the briefs, I thought I read that 601, the argument is made that 601.715 is service for only limited kinds of cases that involve the Commissioner of Insurance or administration of the insurance code. Nope. Yes.
That's the old rule. The fallback rule is actually that you can serve the commissioner. I've only had to do that one time, and that's when there was a bankruptcy of Reliance about 5-10 years ago. We had to serve under the commissioner.
I understand that. But then an argument can be made that 601.715
is not a general statute for all claims against insurance companies. You disagree with that?
I'd have to go back. In fact, the entire plaintiff bar would have to go back and start practicing law differently, because everybody serves the registered agent. Everybody, every single person does. As a matter of fact, in practice, when you go to a subrogated party and you've got a MedPay carrier and you ask if they accept service, they run and hide, because nobody wants the responsibility as an agent. I mean, attorney is one thing. And so some companies, for example, will name their primary defense counsel as a registered agent. And I already knew Attorney Lowe. I took over his job when he left to go to Zurich. I worked at that firm, and I know he's a competent man. And so I know that I can serve the attorney. Under 80114, I serve the attorney. 80114 does not say serve the attorney of record. 80114 says serve the attorney for Zurich. Stan Lowe, at any given time, is the attorney for Zurich. And if I'm nervous about not having personal jurisdiction, which I was, given the multiple statements from Mr. Ratzel, his motion, his limited appearance answer and unbundled legal services, he's only appearing for a single purpose. He never filed a notice of appearance. He only filed a limited purpose answer. That's exactly why we made the decision that we had to serve the registered agent.
What's a limited purpose answer?
In his wherefore clause, where he only asserts an interest under 10229. Actually, we throw around the term subrogation, and since I'm before the Supreme Court, I should admit that I know that 10229 is not subrogation. 10229 is a special animal, and it's
a workers' comp.
It's a workers' comp. It's a third-party claim, exactly, and they can participate in the answer. So it makes it even more significant than if he were a subrogated party. It's akin to a subrogated party, and I know we've used those terms interchangeably. And so it's crystal clear that 601715 is mandatory how you get jurisdiction over an insurance company. That or going to their headquarters. I don't think I could do it by a billboard, but I definitely could take it to Schaumburg and deliver it to their headquarters. But getting back even to 80114, there is no claim. If you look at Mr. Ratzel's answer, the claim has been exhausted with the 10229 settlement. Zurich is a party in waiting. Part of the letter that I sent to the court had more to do with Hanover and Massachusetts Bay. So, for example, Massachusetts Bay is a sister company of Hanover. They're under the Citizen Group. So I go to Attorney Heather Nelson, and I say, I know that you're attorney of record of Hanover because we've got a reducing clause issue, but I know I can get service on you under 80114. I can't get Massachusetts Bay without an original summons. Will you accept the original summons? She did. No question, she answered. I might add that there's no guarantee that Mr. Ratzel would have even answered this complaint. In Otto, the case that was before you 2 years ago today, it was the attorney that didn't answer on behalf of the insurance company when the registered agent had been served. So these things are additional things that could be done, but the gold standard, the safe harbor for anybody making a claim against an insurance company is their registered agent. They've participated in making the rule. I don't think there's ever been any objection to it when the legislature has done it.
Counselor, if you had an attorney in this case, and it was just a multiple claim with regard to an insurance company, say you've made both of your claims to begin with, and you got the same kind of a letter back from Attorney Ratzel, what would you have done?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question. So I served Zurich at the start when Mr. Mubarak had the case alone.
That's right. You served Zurich and Attorney Ratzel responded, but you made both claims.
The issue is joint.
Exactly. Okay. So the next time around, you now add yet another claim. Okay. Because I think the record said you might amend the complaint and add yet another claim. If you added still another claim against Zurich, would you serve their registered agent with that amended complaint?
I've actually been in that situation a fair amount of times, and I can tell you what I've done. Okay. It's always hard to know what you do in each case, but I would have asked Mr. Ratzel. I would have found out. Do you represent them on that claim? Like, for example, let's say his answer back was, "I only represent them for 10229." I would have gone in just like I did to Mr. Lyons. You know, will you accept service? Can I get service through an attorney? Because that's a dicey issue. On whether or not, because somebody's got an open claim against Zurich, can I move to intervene in a completely unrelated case?
Well, you have a new party. If you have someone moving to intervene, then I think the law is pretty clear. You're going to have to do...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I had new parties.
No, but Zurich wasn't a new party.
No.
Zurich was the same old party, a new claim.
I had three new parties.
I understand that there were new parties named in the amended complaint. But Zurich was not a new party. There was just a new claim against Zurich.
I would argue that a party has to be joined, that there has to be joinder of issue. Once the settlement happened, the 10229 order is final, that once there's no claim, there's no attorney and there's no party. Even accepting that, I had new plaintiffs. I had three children.
That were not in the first suit.
That were not in the first suit.
Okay. And they're making claims under the UIM
claims.
Provisions.
Correct.
Okay.
And the wife had made the claims first, Wanda Miller. So I'm adding three new plaintiffs that need to get jurisdiction over an insurance company. I have an attorney that took an official act, which is the vote letter. He accepted the Lyons vote letter, otherwise he couldn't accept the money. So this is not just a letter between counsel, even though I would say you can. I trust but verify, but you can rely on letters from attorneys. You know, they're officers of the court. I took Mr. Ratzel at his word. And then you go and you get that vote letter from somebody. That's an official act. So it's not like a pre-suit letter saying, hey, do you want to go golfing after the scheduling conference or something like that. This is a big deal because it's a condition precedent. I'm running up against statute of limitations because I think the statute of limitations might be 3 years on a derivative claim. These are all significant issues about trying to get jurisdiction to an insurance company. And so while 80114 might be an additional catch-all, I do want to say something before I forget because I'm willing to take any questions, but on this excusable neglect, that has not been appealed. Just like Otto, there's no petition on excusable neglect. Zurich has waived its right to bring a discretionary determination on excusable neglect in our view. They didn't petition for it. We didn't respond to it. In response to the petition, we cited the Otto case where they were precluded from arguing excusable neglect, a discretionary determination. And so they have not asserted that issue before us here today. That they have tried to make an argument that WIA made in the amicus and WIA made in the amicus and Otto, which is that you can have you can go right to an interest of justice, quote unquote, finding even without an excusable neglect. Otto was a decision that the majority, and I'm pretty sure the entire court was unanimous. Well, Justice Gableman wasn't here yet, but that the rest of the court was unanimous because Justice Rogensack, you even said, I have no quarrel in your dissent with the fact that an insurance company has to answer an amended complaint, otherwise the amended complaint is deemed admitted. Amended complaint served on a registered agent when the defendants already had counsel. And I understand the direct action part. The point that I'm making is that I think is significant is that there you have the registered agent again who's been served.
Well, I gather you read 801, if I can find it again, 14, which says, 2, whenever under these statutes service of pleadings and other papers is required to be or permitted to be made on a party represented by an attorney, your view is that the statutes don't require service on an attorney when you've got an insurance company. They require service on the registered agent. Is that your argument?
I was trying to answer that with Justice Rogensack, and I just remembered I did trail off on that. What I'm saying is if they'll accept the service, yes, I can serve them. The Bell case says you may serve an attorney. The issue in the Bell case was, hey, you served the attorney. You didn't serve the registered agent. How is this an effective commencement of an action? So I believe that you can serve the attorney if they'll accept it or if there's an issue joined. My concern here was because I was adding three plaintiffs and the UIM issue had not been joined, I didn't want to face a jurisdictional defense. We got a jurisdictional defense in an answer that was struck. Okay, so that's really what the nub of the issue is. What I'm saying is why does 80114 and the registered agent statute have to fight? Zurich would like you to believe that 80114 trumps the registered agent statute. There's nothing in either of those provisions. They both say shall. One is made by the legislature and one is a Supreme Court rule. They both say shall. There are two effective ways to make service in this case. I could have done either one, but I was uneasy about Mr. Ratzel. The other reason I was uneasy about Mr. Ratzel is because in his motion to the court to approve the distribution, he specifically said in his motion to the court that my interest is over. I need to get my money now because I'm done. And I'm paraphrasing, and we'll get that record citation. But he says specifically making a motion, he actually asked to increase his share to take more money for Zurich away from the Millers. That's just the way it is. It's a limited pool of funds. And so he makes his motion saying, this is it. I can't come back. And that's because of the Bernamort case. he recognized that he did not have subrogation rights. And so specifically at record starting at 142, he says, the $100,000 policy and the $2,000 from defendant James Smith are the only, and he underlines only, source of recovery for Zurich American under my interest. Upon information and belief, there might be other UIM limits available for which Zurich Insurance Company cannot by law share in the recovery of. So another way that I could have served Mr. Ratzel, for example, is if he had a continuing, quote-unquote, subrogation interest. His interest was completely extinguished. His answer, specifically, there was nothing left. Zurich was a placeholder in name only, and the only reason, excuse me for moving away from the microphone, the only reason was that they had to be a placeholder is because there could be continuing subrogation and we didn't want res judicata to attach. That's the main reason. And because his proposed order of dismissal dismissed all defendants, that would have included Hanover. And we had continuing claims against Hanover. So it was essentially a party waiting to be filled, so to speak. But I do disagree that if they were considered a party, because there was no claim, there was no joinder. I don't know if you want to hear more on the excusable neglect. I know Mr. Pines didn't advance it very much, but it's something that I feel very strongly about, that if we go to interest of justice, excusable neglect has not been appealed, that essentially we are rewriting not only 80115, the statute that the court made on default judgments, but we're also overwriting about 50 years of case law, if I count going back, at least that's the oldest default judgment case I could find. So 50 years of case law, and immediate recent precedent of this court, where, like I said, I don't want to speak for any justice, but if I even read the majority and the dissent together, I thought there was harmony in the fact that you must answer complaints, and the issues of the default were not before it. The interest of justice issue was raised there without excusable neglect.
So what does excusable neglect mean?
What a reasonable person could be expected to do under the similar circumstances. The excusable neglect standard is a discretionary determination by the court. It can't be a mere clerical error. There's sufficient case law also talking about, attorneys, unfortunately or fortunately, however you look at it, are held to a very high standard. The Zurich American insurance companies of the world are held to a very high standard under excusable neglect. Lay folks, there are some decisions that tend to be more lenient towards a pro se party when it comes to excusable neglect. But it's a reasonable determination made by a trial court under the circumstances. That's the first prong or the threshold, if I understand the recent authority of Otto. If you get beyond that first threshold, then you can go to interest of justice factors going forward. To bifurcate those two, because there is no statute of limitations on a vacation of a judgment, would jeopardize every judgment in the state of Wisconsin. Because now every single one could be assailed under the interest of justice factors.
Let me move you to another issue. And I don't know if you're going to address it or if you're planning to have co-counsel address it, but that's the issue that you raised, that though a default judgment was granted, it shouldn't have been limited to the amount pled, but you should have been able to prove your damages. Would you talk about that a little bit?
He would have kicked me, and thank you, Your Honor. We pled policies in plural of insurance. We pled all policies of insurance that might be available for Zurich American. The complaint, I could quote it, but I don't want to waste everybody's time. The complaint sets forth multiple policies. It's a plural. We claim damages. Much like the complaint in Otto was different, and if I understand your dissent, Justice Rogan-Sack, it was the direct action. That was the nub of the problem in that. This is a first-party claim. And so we made all the claims, negligence caused harm. Mr. Ratzel admitted all those things, not that he was counsel, but even in the 10229 because he accepted the money. So we never, in our wherefore clause, demanded a specific sum of money. That would have been wholly inappropriate. So we have two cases, Leonard Martin. Which case are we more like? Martin's the case where in the ad damnum, they say this is a $150,000 case. Because this is UIM, we do allege a certain policy of insurance that we know about. But we know enough about doing this type of work that there might be other policies. We're alleging all, other policies that could be available. And more specifically, in our wherefore clause, when we're setting forth the damages, we're setting forth a full amount. The Stein case is the one that really controls. And the Stein case says that once you get into a default situation, that's when you set forth our damages. It's unfortunate that the proof required us to ask for a total amount of damages for almost $15 million. I don't know how much you know about the damages in this case, but Burl Miller has had 50 surgeries.
I saw the exhibit.
Yes. He's got a hemipelvectomy. It's torn the family apart. And so it doesn't matter if it's $15 or $15 million. We have to ask for what the proof required. The judge, in his discretion, limited that to $9.6 million. I am unclear, even though the trial court did everything right up to that point, I am unclear on the rationale for the lowering of it to $2 million. I recognize that we pled one of the policies was $2 million. We knew about the policies. I vehemently disagree, by the way, that there's no coverage. Okay, it's clear on the declaration page that there's coverage. It says it's included. And the part that Zurich cites is not part of the policy. They cite a precursor letter that from an agent saying about, you know, whether they're going to reject coverage. Zurich gave coverage. It's in the deck page. But we pled any and all policies. And in the record, under Stein, another $50 million insurance policy comes in. So that's one way that you could say the 9.6 is within the $50 million. The other way is if you look at the Leonard Catnack case, that insurance policy was only $100,000 or $150,000, I forget. The point is that the damages were around $300,000, and in a default situation, the Leonard court allowed the plaintiffs to collect the full amount of damages because under Stein, it's the insurance company's responsibility to join the issue, answer the complaint, and limit it to the insurance policies. So the allegations of our complaint is that there was coverage and that the policy should be applied, just like Otto. So at Otto, the issue never came up. In that case, on what's the limit and so forth, it's what are the amount of the damages? What are the amount of the damages? We don't get into these issues of, whether there's a defense. For example, in auto, there could have been a negligence defense, causation defense. It is medical negligence, after all. So there is no authority to limit the amount of damages set by the trial court. And I might add, in fairness to Judge McAlpine and in fairness to Zurich and in fairness to my client, we had full discovery. Not only were there four default damages hearings to determine excusable neglect and the other issues, there were 5 full days of trial. They had full experts. They had a life care planner. We had a life care planner. They had vocational experts. This was full discovery to determine what the right and fair amount was. I did notice on the response brief on the damage issue, Mr. Pines did bring up this collateral source issue or something like that. I don't believe that that's a Supreme Court issue. That is a judgment issue for the trial court.
Counsel, in your 4 hearings and 5 full days of trial, what, if anything, happened to your bad faith claim?
Well, how did Judge McAlpine rule on that?
That's okay. If
it wasn't before the court. The punitive claim.
You made reference to it in your brief in footnote 4. And it's like maybe on remand if appropriate, and I just didn't know what the status of that was.
No, the remand if appropriate had nothing to do with bad faith.
Okay.
The remand if appropriate had to do with the collateral source rule, because I do believe that that is a judgment issue, and that is that they've paid some sums of money. They didn't prove up.
Medical.
This is what you say.
Medical expenses.
And this is footnote 3, I think. For purposes of the default damages prove up for judgment, the plaintiffs, and I'm reading from page 17, footnote 3, the plaintiffs did not proceed with the bad faith and punitive damages allegations. They have reserved their right to proceed on those claims at a later time as appropriate, but they were not at issue on appeal and are not an issue for review. So since they're not, I guess it was more a matter
You're right. We could have, I suppose, proceeded on those things. We made the determination with my client not to.
Okay.
But I would add, this is continuing first party. And so what you're reading in the footnote is correct. You always don't want to give up completely your right, depending on how Zurich continues to treat its insured. And so, but you're right. For the purposes of the default, we did not proceed with the prove up. The way we read the statute, I mean, it's a good question because it's been a while since I read it. I think that there was some issue with the punitive, some element. That we didn't feel comfortable with. And so we went with compensatory damages.
Thank you.
I see my red.
You may sum up your argument very, very, very briefly.
Okay, please. I'm sorry. So essentially on the service of process issue under 801.14, because there was no joinder, because there was no claim alive anymore, and the conflict, and I wouldn't even say conflict. I would argue that 601.715 and 801.14 are in harmony. Why should we make it difficult for people to sue somebody as long as they have notice? As long as they're called into court and have notice. In fact, the Carolyn Fountain affidavit, I think, is instructive because she says that she would have forwarded everything to GAB anyway. I think Mr. Ratzel, you could even read his affidavit as saying, I would have forwarded, you know, this information to the client. So they got notice. But there really was no claim being made. So we served him appropriately under the registered agent. And since there wasn't any claim joined, that I think that serving Mr. Ratzel under 801.14 would have been perilous. And with statutes of limitations, and we don't get a second chance to serve. There's no excusable neglect at all for statute of limitations, not serving within 90 days. And, I might add, they have 45 days to answer, and we only have 90 days for service. Under Jim Ratzel's own letter, he says that I'm not the attorney, and the vote letter was by somebody else, his own motion.
Now, let me ask you one question. I'm sorry that it's your red light's on, but do you agree or disagree that a new summons was not required as to Zurich? An amended summons.
I disagree. I believe that Zurich was a new party at that point. It's a new insurance policy. It's, for example, I'll just give you an example in Zurich's own brief. They've argued that the $50 million policy isn't their policy. It's got Zurich all over the front of it, but the argument that they've made is that that's not their policy. We don't know in this record that the workers' comp policy is in fact a Zurich policy. They have four companies. So I had no confidence that the UIM policy and a business auto policy, an umbrella policy, where Zurich is probably, I don't know, one or two number one insurance companies in the world, and they have four sub companies, all having, and two in Wisconsin having the same registered agent. We still don't have the workers' comp policy, even though we've been trying to get it. I have no, and it's not part of the record, I have no confidence that this was the same entity. And in my line of work, you can't afford to make those kind of mistakes. You need to get that notice to the insurance company. I would not want to be before you standing up for my, under this record, standing up for my service of Jim Ratzel and only Jim Ratzel. In my view, that would be a very perilous position. In my view, a summons was absolutely required to give them the notice necessary that we're making a new claim against you. And I disagree with Mr. Pine's reading of the last two sentences of 801.14. Contempt is one thing. There's three things that you need to directly serve a party with.
Counsel, when I asked you a similar question to that asked by Justice Ziegler, I thought that you responded that the amended complaint not only made a new claim, but there were new plaintiffs who were not plaintiffs in the first case. Did I misunderstand you?
No, you were correct.
That's another reason you needed
right,
to serve.
Right, you've got new parties, so you have to get personal jurisdiction for the new parties claim.
I was being sensitive at the time, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we never are, so.
Oh, I'm not a frequent flyer, so I wanted to make sure. Yeah. I wanted to make sure. Like I said, on the excusable neglect, I'll be as quick as I can. It's asking to cut off one of the arms of the remedial statute. I know it's a consequential statute, but there is no like reprieve for us if we file a case one day beyond the statute of limitations. Excusable neglect is recent precedent. I believe it's unanimous precedent, and the rules have consequences. And I believe I covered my damages, and I've taken up your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Urban. You have 5 minutes in Surrey bottle. Mr. Pines.
Thank you. I said in my brief that it was important for the court to decide this case on the facts in the record and not on a fictional set of facts. And I want to reiterate that. The one thing that you did not hear from Mr. Urban was this. The facts that the circuit court determined and that the Court of Appeals accepted are Zurich American Insurance Company was always a party to this case. It was never dismissed from it. James Ratzel was Zurich's attorney of record at the time the Miller's amended complaint was filed. Those are the facts. All of this business about they were a new party, we had to do this and we had to do that, is what Mr. Urban thought when he wrote to the court. This is at appendix at 130, our appendix at 130. He says, two of these insurers are new parties to this action and will be served via their respective registered agents. Zurich was not a new party.
Councillor, I think that, you know, we're maybe mixing apples and oranges a little bit, but just let me ask you a question which is bothering me. If you add a new plaintiff to a case, even though the defendant has been lurking around for a long time, how do you get personal jurisdiction over the defendant for the new plaintiff's claims if you don't serve the party?
You can add new plaintiffs in an amended complaint, and if a party is a party to the case, the new plaintiffs come within the jurisdiction of the court. You do not have to serve on the summons.
Give me a cite. Do you have a case that you can tell me that?
I can't give you. It's the provision that governs the service of amended complaints, which I will tell you shortly.
Okay. Thank you. She can look it up.
Yeah.
And you can
that section of the statutes says when there's an amended complaint. It doesn't say it's amended complaints and whether it's new parties or not. Zurich is in the case.
I know we have case law, and I can't tell you the case, but I know it arose out of federal law that says if you have a cross-claim between two defendants, where there never was a cross-claim before, but they were both defendants, you got to serve the guy against the new claim, and he was a party all along.
And if that is true, if we were even to say that they had to serve a summons with this on Zurich for those parties, they are not allowed to serve Zurich generally with the amended complaint. You know, they could have done both if they felt they had to. The plaintiff is arguing here, I was under such stress. I didn't know what to do. I had to make sure I didn't do something wrong. Oh, okay. So what he decided to do is serve Zurich directly and ignore the attorney of record, which the statute, by the way, does not, the statute says, whenever these statutes, service of pleadings or other papers is required or permitted to be made upon a party represented by counsel, required or permitted to be made, required or permitted. And 601.715(6) says, except as provided in sub 5, this section does not limit or affect the rights to serve summons, notice, orders, pleadings, demands, or other process upon an authorized insurer in any other manner provided by law. Well, what's provided by law is that when a party's in a case and you have an amended complaint, you serve it on the attorney of record. And the facts, the only facts, are Zurich American Insurance Company was always a party to this case. You know, there's all of these strange phrases that are thrown around in the plaintiff's argument. Party in waiting. Where's that? Party in waiting? Involuntary defendant. What's that? Isn't every defendant involuntary? What's a voluntary defendant? Oh, okay. Come and say, I'm happy to be sued. And a voluntary defendant is, don't sue me. Don't sue me. There's only one thing in the statutes. It's a defendant.
Is there an involuntary plaintiff? I think
People label things involuntary plaintiff. The statute doesn't talk about involuntary plaintiffs. You know, the point here is, for whatever reason, the plaintiffs didn't follow the statute. And they can come up with 1,000 reasons why they didn't follow the statute. But they didn't follow the statute. If they didn't follow the statute, they're not entitled to a default judgment. It's quite simple. It's a bright line rule. It's a bright line rule. You read the statute says this is how you serve an amended complaint. You can do both. But a party represented by an attorney has a right to rely on that attorney. There is no way that this court can make its decision based on anything but the circuit court's determination that James Ratzel was Zurich's attorney of record at the time the amended complaint was filed. That's the finding in this case.
What was he party of record for?
He represented the Zurich American Insurance Company.
For what?
For whatever purpose there was.
So he was kind of general attorney, even if there wasn't a claim filed. If, let's say, amended complaint, there's no problem with statute of limitations. It was filed months and months and months after the 102-29 settlement.
As it was here.
Yeah. And all of that time, even if no claim was
being, even if no claim existed against Zurich, he was still an attorney representing Zurich, but he wasn't representing them for any claim.
Well, here's the problem. The plaintiff said, don't dismiss Zurich American Insurance Company. We have these potential further claims that we want to make. It took them a year and a half. There is nothing at all that altered Zurich status or Ratzel status. Nothing. Zurich was in that case for whatever purpose the plaintiffs were going to eventually deal with. But Zurich doesn't disappear and Ratzel doesn't disappear when the plaintiff says, we want this held open, we want these parties in, don't dismiss them. There's no other way to view it. I know that my time is up. I want to comment on the issue of the damages.
Very briefly, Mr. Pines.
Very, very briefly. The court can look at the Miller Appendix, page 82, which is the commercial umbrella liability policy. This is the $50 million policy. I commend the court to my brief, which goes through step by step what their complaint says. They continue to assert that this policy was a Zurich policy, despite the fact that at page 80 of the Miller Appendix, it says that this policy was issued by the American Guarantee Liability Insurance Company. And on the at page 82, it lists the insurance is provided by the company designated on the declarations page of this policy. The court made a finding that the American Guarantee and Liability Insurance Company is not the Zurich American Insurance Company. Despite a Zurich symbol, it's a separate legal entity, and in fact, the other three potential legal entities that are listed here are not the Zurich American Insurance Company. So they found a policy of some sort that's got a Zurich symbol, and they audaciously are telling this court, well, it's a Zurich American Insurance Company policy. And it's not.
Thank you, Mr. Pines. Mr. Urban?
Could I get the court the citation on amendment claim 804?
Thank you.
I think I'm limited to damages, but Justice Rogensack, if you'd like that cite, I have it.
Okay, great.
It's Biggert. You cite it in your dissent in Otto. It's the Biggert line of cases, Biggart versus Barstad, and that has to do with how it doesn't relate back if you name different parties and different insurance companies. I think you cited it for a direct action purpose, but there's a line of cases about bringing in new parties and summonses. We didn't invent any type of Zurich American insurance policy here. We were allowed to proceed on an amended complaint. We needed to make an amended complaint to add new claims. And at the time that we filed our amended complaint, Zurich had been dismissed. At record page 27, Judge McAlpine had dismissed Zurich. What happened is during the process of the default, he vacated that order. So at a later time, that order was vacated. That is true. But I do feel compelled to correct the record that at the time we actually filed the complaint, Zurich was dismissed. And that order is in the record. I didn't pull the Zurich American policies that were issued in this case out of thin air. We issued a subpoena for all policies well before the amended complaint was filed. And what we were produced was the policy that we pled. Then what we were produced later on, and I might add that Attorney Craig Nelson, who was representing Zurich at all times up until we got to the at some point in the appellate process here, he actually entered these policies into the court. The policy referred to by Mr. Pines is not it's not a certified policy, but it does say Zurich right on it. And it kind of goes to amplify the point when Justice Siegler, when you were asking the question earlier about you know, if you're serving one company, how do you make sure that you're serving the correct company? It's an application of the point, because the policy says Zurich. It says it all over the place. And then there's an American Guarantee company. You know, there's subparts. It says General Parts Inc., which is the insured. There's self-insured retentions. And this is why it's in order for us to be able to make a claim in UIM within, you know, either for the policy and to say that there is additional insurance coverage, that we have to make sure that we have a summons and so that we can prove our damages, because we knew they were going to be significant. And so at the record at pages 81, 82, for example, and I'm referring to, we've thrown out a lot of numbers here. This is plaintiff appellant cross respondents cross appeal index. And so that's at page 82. The bigger point is this. Under the Leonard case, we don't even get to that point. In the Otto case, the question never was reached, what is the insurance coverage? The time for them to make the allegations that they want to make, that there's no coverage to limit our damages, at the time of answering the complaint. Zurich exists to absorb the risk of these companies. It's in the business of getting claims being made against it, large and small. And the preferred method that they want to be served is through a registered agent. So when we claimed under these policies, we claimed additional policies in case there's umbrellas. And it's in the record that in this case, we have an excess, because it's deemed admitted by the complaint and by Otto, we have $52 million worth of insurance policies under the Stein case. Zurich has not been able to limit those things. They can say now, as an officer of the court, can come in here and say it's not our policy, but it's deemed admitted. And it's Zurich, and it was received under subpoena from GAB Robbins. We didn't get it and manufacture it. Judge McAlpine received these into evidence. Craig Nelson, because there's a Heather Nelson in the case, brought the insurance policies to the court. These are the insurance policies at issue. And under the Leonard case, the insurance policies aren't really even the issue, because once you're in default, it's the measure of the damages. And without an addendum clause, the measure of damages we made, at some point Judge McAlpine said, what are your damages, and then we're going to have a trial on them. That's when we made our claim for damages for $15 million, which was supported by the record. Judge McAlpine had a full trial and reduced those damages to $9.6 million. The further reduction, like I said, is not supported in my reading of the complaint, is for policy or policies, and we have $52 million in coverage.
Counsel, tell me again, where is it in the record that Zurich was dismissed, that they weren't a party? Or did I misunderstand what you said?
Page, it's not in the appendix, I don't believe it's in the record, page 27, I know that for sure. And this is an order signed by Judge McAlpine on January 7th of 2006. He vacated that order.
January 27?
January 17, 2006.
Okay, that's when the order for dismissal is in the CPAP
that he vacated,
record.
Right. I'm not here misrepresenting the record. I'm correcting a statement that the order that Judge McAlpine made that, you know, Zurich was always a party, that was made retroactively. In fact, in my letter to the court, which is Appendix 130, I specifically say Zurich is a new party. All of us were thinking Zurich would be a new party because there was no claim joined. It was vacant, and I apologize for not using a better word, but it just had to do with the fact that res judicata. It's a new party.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Urban.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Your
Mr. Honor. Pine. That's highly unusual in light of all of this argument, unless Mr. Urban does not object. Then we will conclude this argument, and I want to thank Mr. Pines and thank Mr. Urban for a spirited argument on it is usually Civil Procedure 101 of who do you serve and when. And the court will look at the record very carefully in light of your argument, Mr. Pines, and your argument, Mr. Urban, and with all due deliberate speed, reach a decision and issue an opinion. That concludes our hearing in 2008 AP 1494, Miller versus Hanover in Zurich, America. We are in recess until 1:30. The students should remain, and Justice Bradley will be out these issues with you, and you all, anyone other than the students, may also remain.